The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning. Last week when I gave a talk on the Four Noble Truths. And those of you who've never heard of the Four Noble Truths, I'll just mention what they are very briefly. And then hopefully you'll follow along. Four Noble Truths are at the heart of what the Buddha had to teach and what Buddhism is about. And a lot of the other philosophies, teachings, realizations that Buddhism points to arise out of these core insights or approaches or to life. And the first truth is the truth that there is conflict. Last week I called it conflict. There is suffering in life. It doesn't say life is suffering, it says in life there is suffering. The second is that that suffering has an origin, has a causal beginning, and Buddhism points to the origin to be clinging or grasping. And then, and it's possible to seize the grasping and thereby seize the suffering that comes from that grasping. And then there's a path that's connected to that process. There's a path of practice that helps us to do that, that expresses that, manifests that freedom, that brings that freedom from suffering, from clinging. So these are four pragmatic truths. They're not meant to be kind of absolute creeds that we believe in. They're supposed to be, one way of seeing them is that they are pragmatic. They are approaches, orientations that we could use for living in our life more wisely. If what you want to do is to find a gas station, then you don't go look in your bedroom closet. You know, you look in particular place for gas stations. So if you have a particular approach, orientation, or desire, wish for your life, it helps to know what orientation you need to. So if you're lost, if you're in the wilderness and you want to find your way out, perhaps you'd look for, you've been trained perhaps, and you've trained to look in certain signs or in the wilderness to help you find the way out. You don't start studying how the ants make their anthills when you're lost. That's not going to be a useful thing to do, but rather maybe you look for see where the sun is and what direction it is and a variety of kind of other things. And so if you've been trained, you know what to look for. So the Four Noble Truths are the orientation or the evidence or the that helps us find our way. Now what's, I think, for me personally, one of the things that's significant about the way the Four Noble Truths are formulated, there is no personal pronoun in them. It doesn't say, you suffer, and there's a cause in you for your suffering, and that cause is your clinging, and if you follow a path, you'll somehow be connected to freedom. There's no pronoun at all. So for me, I take that as certain liberty involved that you can assign pronouns as you wish. And I think that at the heart, or that one of the primary ways it's interpreted is the pronoun is for yourself. There is suffering in your life, and if you cling, you'll suffer, and if you let go of that clinging, you will become free of that suffering. There is conflict in your life. If you understand the origin of that conflict, your contribution to it, and your clinging, then the suffering connected to that conflict go away. Perhaps interpersonal conflict necessarily won't go away, but whatever distress you feel about it will. And so a lot of what Buddhism is about is really doing the sometimes very, very deep work, very sometimes complex work, of really understanding all the things that are involved or contribute to our suffering, our clinging and all that. So one way of understanding is for me. Another way is to understand it them or us. We suffer as a society. We suffer as a family, as a community, as a nation, as a country, as a world, that there's suffering. And it's not, you don't have to go very far to run into suffering that's not your own personal suffering, but is a suffering of many other people, collective suffering or suffering of a large collection of people who share the same thing. So like right now, there's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people in Haiti who are suffering, and we can't deny it. So are the Four Noble Truths relevant for understanding our collective life? Can we say, oh, those people there are suffering, and well, they're just clinging to something, those people in Haiti. And they should just let go of their clinging. And to say that, I think, would be not only a disservice, but kind of add worse than salt in a wound. But the distinction that Buddhism makes is between pain and suffering. And there's a lot of pain that doesn't necessarily involve suffering. And there's suffering, suffering for Buddhists involves that kind of pain that arises from clinging. So it's kind of Buddhist, when you talk to hear a Buddhist, you have to always interpret it that way. When Buddhists talk about suffering, they're talking about the suffering that arises from clinging. And there's a lot of other kinds of pain. So certainly I can imagine there's suffering in Haiti that comes from clinging. And I saw in the paper today all the reports about all this looting and violence that's going on there, rioting and stuff that's going on in the aftermath of the earthquake. So that represents a fair amount of clinging involved. And you don't have to do a big analysis of the news or the world around us to find someone's clinging or craving or grasping, someone's compulsivity as the origin for many of the big things we read about in the newspaper. Someone's greed, someone's ambition, someone's hate, something, or a collective group of people's ambition or greed or hate, fear, or all variations of clinging that then have a collective impact on many, many people around. And I think one of the contributions Buddhism makes is to help us have the tools and the skills to look back into the heart, into the mind, to understand something about the nature of that clinging. Because if we never look at that, if we only fix policy, then we're never really going to address the core issues the core issues of a human being. You can feed someone forever. You can bring them all kinds of consumer goods. You can set them up in a big house, do all kinds of wonderful things, and they might be much more comfortable. But they might also their suffering, at the core of their being, might still be there. And as we know, we hear lots of stories. I've heard lots of stories. Comparative stories, people compare the degree of happiness in the United States, which is considered to be overall, on the average or something like that, with all kinds of exceptions, an affluent country. And they compare it to countries in the world that are far from affluent, some that are poor, and some people are quite surprised that the contagious sense of happiness in the streets and among people is so much stronger than what goes on in this country. And when I was a young man, traveling in countries like, I remember it was in Barbados, which was a relatively poor Caribbean country. As far as I'd been to many, many countries by the time I went there, I grew up living in different countries all over. And I had to say it was the happiest group of people that I ever encountered in my life, the people in Barbados. And so having wealth and lots of things is not necessarily the source of it, of happiness. So what is it? So Buddhism has a contribution to understand the psychology of it all. So here's two stories from the Zen tradition. And the two stories are these two sides that I'm trying to talk about today. The side of the personal practice, oneself, looking at oneself, and the other has to do with our relationship to the world outside of us. How do we relate to that world out there, to Haiti, to suffering, to people out there? It's their suffering. Do we just kind of shut down and, when we get enough people into IMC, then we lock the doors, so we can just meditate and get our act together and keep those people out? Or do we keep our doors open and our hearts open, and somehow our practice has a direct bearing on how we relate to the wider world? What is that? So the first story is a famous story that's well worth repeating of the two Chinese monks who were traveling on foot around China in the old days. And they came to a river and they encountered a woman who somehow, because of her condition, as whatever, wasn't able to cross the river. And so she was distressed, she was needed to get across. One of the monks saw this and simply picked her up and forded the river, carrying her across, and then put her down the other side, and then the two monks continued. That evening, when they finally came to a monastery, the second monk couldn't contain himself anymore, and he burst out and said, "How could you have done that? You're a monk, and monks are not supposed to touch women. And here you picked, not only you touched her, but you picked her up, you held her in your arms, and you carried her across the river. How could you have done that?" And the first monk said, "I put the woman down by the river. Why are you still carrying her?" Oh. Why are you still holding on to her? So that, I think, is a very, very powerful story when you ask yourself, what are you still carrying? What are you still holding on to? Are you still carrying resentments? Are you still carrying hurts? Are you still carrying attachments, desires? Are you still carrying viewpoints, opinions about people that are ancient? Or are you able to put things down and see each situation fresh and new? Here, this is what's happening here now. And so, to ask the question, what am I still holding to? What am I clinging to? Is a very significant question. And to ask that, what am I still holding on to here? If you're troubled by something, what are you carrying with you for days and days, weeks and weeks, years and years? So now the second story, also from China, the Chinese monk story, of two monks who are also traveling. And there was a custom in ancient China, old China, for monks to spend a good part of their life or years wandering around, visiting different monasteries, visiting different teachers and questioning them and getting teachings. So it was a lot of wandering stories. So these monks, two monks, were wandering, looking for a teacher. One of them, they were looking for a teacher to practice with and checking out different monasteries. And as they approached one famous monastery, there was a river that ran down from the monastery past the path where they were walking up. And they noticed that coming down the river from the monastery was a single leaf of lettuce that somehow, maybe they'd been washing it up the river or somehow gotten out of the kitchen or down the drain or something, it'd gotten away, a single leaf of lettuce. And so one of the monks saw this and said, a monastery that can be that wasteful is not a good place to practice. Let's go find another place. And they started to turn around. And just then, they heard this running footsteps coming on the path from the monastery. And it was the cook running after that lettuce. And he picked it up and took it back. And then they said, oh, this is a good place to practice. So a single leaf of lettuce, that's significant enough to choose where you practice? And what does someone else's relationship to a piece of lettuce have to do with your place of how you want to practice, where you should practice? And why would that cook be so concerned about a single leaf of lettuce to be running out of the monastery and down the path to find that? Why is that so significant? What are the lettuces that you let go of? What are the lettuces that you discard disrespectfully? Oh, that doesn't count, it's not important. What do you not notice that you need to, that you're responsible for, that maybe you should care for more carefully? I'm very touched by the fact that the health of people in the Central Valley, people at places like Fresno, both the people, children who get asthma, and the trees in the lower realms of Sierra there, are very much impacted by the smog that's produced by the people in the Bay Area, which means me. You know, I can, you know, I get the ocean influence, you know, I get relatively clean air compared to them. But, you know, there's a way in which the air kind of blows it right into the Central Valley and settles there against the foothills. That's our leaf. That's our lettuce leaf. I mean, we can't go get it. That's not the point. But I'm very conscious of it and aware of it. And how do I take that in? How do I live with that awareness? Do I just forget it? Well, that was interesting. I read it once in the newspaper and then drive with abandon. Or do I somehow live with that as a living memory, something that's important to keep in mind? And I feel it's important to keep in mind as I choose how often I drive and how much I drive. I remember, oh, the kids in Fresno. And, you know, and there's a lot of things like that. What impact do we have? And does caring for our life and our relationship to other people, is that an important part of Buddhist spirituality? And I would say it's a very important part of it, that we don't just care for ourselves and our suffering, but we also care for that of others. We respond to it. But here's a very important point, and that is that Buddhism does not obligate us to any of this. Buddhism does not say, thou shalt be free of suffering. Thou shalt not cling. It says, rather, there is suffering. And if you're interested in not suffering in this way, then there's a possibility for you to let go of your clinging. And there's a practice to help you do that. A practice of mindfulness, of careful attention, and other things. And Buddhism it's not a religion that has a god. And this is a very important point, because when there's no religion, not a god, there's no one ordering you around. No one kind of setting the rules for you. There is no kind of like deity arbitrating what's going to happen to you. And so Buddhism is a kind of religion that there's no place in Buddhism to obligate anybody to do anything. And who's going to do it? We can't resort to our God, say, hey, you know, our God says this, therefore I'm going to make sure you do it. And we don't have a God. And so if you don't have a God, I mean, then who's going to be in charge? You know? I mean, you know, should we have an election to decide who's the supreme Buddhist? Who's going to make the rules for us? There is no one. So Buddhism doesn't obligate us to respond to the world around us, be socially concerned. This is very challenging to some people, especially here in the West. There's a very strong social gospel in the West coming out of the late 1900s, where there's a really big expectation that people involved in religion are involved in social help and aid and all that. It's almost like a requirement to do it. But Buddhism doesn't have a requirement like that, so therefore Buddhism must be kind of like just a selfish religion, or something. Maybe it's not a religion at all. So there's no obligation. However, I think it works like this. That if you put your hand on a hot frying pan, you pull your hand back. Your hand gets pulled back. You don't even think about it. That's what you do. If someone collapses with a heart attack in front of you on the street, you don't walk on. You don't even think about it. You drop down to support the person, to do something, or call 911 or something. There's a response. There is a kind of responsivity that people do that doesn't belong to the world of a lot of analysis, consideration. It doesn't even belong to that, to... it's you know, what's good for me. And so maybe to give another example, for people who are parents, maybe this is something you're familiar with, that parents care for their children, especially when the kids are really small, can have a quality of selflessness in it, where the child's welfare is so automatic to take care of that it's not, you know, it doesn't even compute the idea, well, I'm missing my night's sleep. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, if your spouse says, you know, I can't sleep, 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, entertain me. You know, there's probably not much sympathy. But if your two-month-old baby is crying 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, there can be, that's not always the case, but it can be kind of almost, it's almost like instinct. It's almost like, you know, you don't think about it. It's not like, oh, you know, poor me, and why should I do this? It's just kind of like automatic. Oh, this way. It's like the baby's almost an extension of you. There's another Chinese koan, Chinese teaching, Zen. Don't remember that well, but it's something like, what is it like for what is it like for the great bodhisattva, the great kind of personification of compassion, to be compassionate? So the Avalokiteshvara, Kuan Yin, was just considered this almost like a goddess who had, or god, that had all this work, all this compassion in the world. It was a very dramatic kind of compassion work in the myths. So what's it like to have compassion like this great goddess? And the response, the teacher said, oh, it's like bunching up the pillow at night. So, you know, you're a little bit, you know, you're half asleep and you're kind of uncomfortable, a little bit, and it's unselfconscious that you just kind of move the pillow a little bit to make yourself a little more comfortable. You're not doing it for any so anybody can see what a great pillow buncher-upper you are. You're not trying to prove a point to yourself. It's not competitive. You know, it's just, you know, it's almost not self-conscious. You're not self-conscious in a self-conscious kind of way. It's kind of like, you know, it's almost like the pillow's an extension of you. That's how it is for the great compassion to operate in the world. So what happens when we look at ourselves in a very, very honest way, not just with the ordinary thinking mind, which is limited in how well and deep it can see, but when we let the mind become still, quiet, calm, with a heightened capacity of perception, a heightened ability to see the details of what goes on within our psychology? And what happens if we let go of what we hold on to, what we cling to? What happens if we let go of the... And clinging involves resistance, being closed. And one of the things that happens, I believe, to most people, is that we become more sensitive, become more tender, become more aware. That if we're preoccupied and caught up with things, you hardly even notice your neighbor or the person standing near you. But if you're not caught up in your concerns and preoccupations, you'll notice much more likely the person sitting next to you, the persons around you. If you're caught up in the sense of self-identity and how competitive everything else and how you want to compete as the best person, you might notice the people around you. But what do you notice about them? You notice how they threaten your quest for superiority or your quest for something or identity. Or how you notice how they threaten your fear if you're trying to be safe and secure and you feel very insecure. And so you notice particular things about them. But if desires, ambition, status, fear, sense of insecurity, all those are kind of holdings, things that we hold on to. If those things drop away, then the awareness becomes much more available to notice something more acutely or more direct or deeper about that person around you. You don't notice how they're competing for your status. You don't notice how they threaten your whatever. But you notice maybe what we can call their humanity. You get a sense of perhaps something deeper about them, how they are. And we can notice, oh, that person is happy or that person's suffering. And if we, this idea of empathy becomes stronger. Empathic connectivity is a sense of is one of the consequences for many people when they do meditation practice, when they do mindfulness practice. And then what arises as a result of empathy? What are the consequences of having empathy? And empathy is a beautiful capacity. It's different than contagious emotions. Contagious emotions mean you're kind of like you're a victim almost of people's emotions. But empathy is you feel someone else's emotion, so you have empathy, and you're concerned about it. You feel kind of heartfeltness with it. It's connected to compassion when they're suffering. And so when there is less selfing, less self-preoccupation, less operations of greed and fear and hate and all these things operating, then I think that there's no obligation to help your neighbor. But I think often enough it can be the response that comes out of that sensitive open heart. And if there's obligation, it comes from anywhere. It doesn't come from externally, from Buddhism, certainly not. If it comes from anywhere, the obligation comes from your heart. But to use the word obligation is too heavy. Because obligation, to me, at least in my vocabulary, sounds like a lot of clinging. Or a lot, I feel kind of oppressed by the word. I have to do something. But it comes, I think, there's no obligation, but it comes, but you can't, but also it's not appropriate to, I think sometimes we do ourselves a huge disservice by shutting down and closing down the response that wants to come out. Well, let me help here. Let me do something. As our preoccupations and attachments settle down and there's a greater sensitivity, awareness to the world around us, greater empathy, there then also arises what in many spiritual traditions is referred to as a greater understanding of the interconnected nature of this world we live in. And one of the highest kind of worldly or highest and almost mystical experiences relating to our interdependent, related worlds is to a clear sense of how amazingly interrelated and interconnected we are. And it's considered among some mystics, mystical traditions, the highest mystical experience is a tremendous oneness or tremendous sense of interconnectedness or mutuality that's always here. Buddhism doesn't hold that kind of experience as the highest point of the spiritual path. But at least in the world of how we relate to everything else, it's the highest. And it rises out of, in Buddhism it's often expressed or comes together with loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and things like that. It's not ultimate, but it gets pretty close. As the heart's the mind settles and get quieter, peaceful, and perhaps certain brain centers don't operate so much, it seems that one of the powerful experiences people can have is a sense of interconnectedness and how everything relates to everything else. In Mahayana Buddhism, again coming out of China, there was a beautiful image for this called Indra's net. And Indra's net, and Indra was kind of a god in the Indian pantheon. And so it was kind of a cosmic net. And in each corner, each kind of joint in the net, there's a mirror, or maybe many mirrors pointing in all directions. And each mirror reflects each of the other junctions of the net. And so if you've ever been in a changing room where you kind of all these couple of different mirrors and you kind of like becomes like an infinite number of you, go back and forth, infinite regress. It's enough with one, but and so this Indra's net is like that, where it's not just one person being reflected many times, but everything is being reflected infinite number of times in every possible mirror, going back and back. So that's supposed to be an image of how amazingly interconnected we are. Buddhism, as I understand it, does not make any ultimate absolutisms out of the sense or experience we can have of interconnectedness. It doesn't make some kind of absolute philosophy. We're saying we're all interconnected. You know, what does the butterfly flapping its wing in Ladakh have to do with, you know, the rain running down the gutter at my street? You know, maybe you can make an argument for how it's connected, but it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, it's, functionally there's no connection, right? But to say everything's connected to everything else is kind of, I think, a little bit a silly thing to say. It's silly in the sense that it's it has no functional or pragmatic value. If it's symbolic, or if it kind of speaks to some kind of experience that we have, a sense, a feeling, that's okay. Buddhism is very reluctant, has always been very reluctant to make these kinds of absolute statements. What it does, though, however, is when there's a strong sense of interconnectedness that can exist, it's always emphasized that interconnectedness shouldn't be abstracted as a concept, but it's something that that we understand in the particulars of our life. The things that we encounter and see and feel, that there's where we can feel it and see it. And it can be the immediate things, the lettuce leaves we discard. It can be those things we read about in the newspaper, you know, where there is a connection between us and Haiti. Not just a heartfelt one, but there's other all kinds of ways in which Western society, Western culture kind of, you know, all these Western societies kind of co-created over the last 200 years. But in the particulars, and so Buddhism keeps coming back to the particular. So here, in this situation, in this particular situation, what is the connection we have? What's the connection we could have? Let's not get into the abstractions, let's not get into the metaphysical kind of absolutisms. Let's be content of settling and open our hearts the best we can, and from that open-heartedness, let's see what we meet in that open-heartedness, and let's see what arises from that. What arises from it? And in different situations, different things arise. And for me, the last few days, reading about Haiti, I just, first I thought, oh, I'm going to send a donation. And then I thought, I think that what I'll do instead is I won't take any donations today when I teach. And let's just like to take all of that and let all that go, whatever it might be, to Haiti. Because that's kind of just, that just came out of me. That's what I wanted to do. That's something I could do. And maybe I'll think about more things as time goes along. Maybe IMC will think about things as a community. What comes out of our hearts when the heart is open? What comes out of a sense of connection, of connectivity, of being connected? So connected that it's almost like it's not you over there and me here. It's almost so connected that it's almost like you are me. Not quite, but almost. It's as if your situation is my situation. If your suffering is my suffering. And coming out of my Buddhist practice, this has been a very significant has become a very significant part of my life in a way that I couldn't imagine before I practiced. The way in which I can take in experience people, situations beyond me, outside of me, and feel like it's almost me. I'm not separate from it. I can't ignore it, because to ignore it is to ignore my own hand. It is who I am. And so we care for it. And this is why I often like to say, that no one can do Buddhist practice without sooner or later doing it for others as well. Because as sooner or later as you do Buddhist practice, this deeper sensitivity and openness of the heart comes forth. And then the sense of separation, of here and there, it doesn't make sense anymore. It does make sense. It makes some sense. It's logical. It still has a place. But it's almost as if, or as a big part of that barrier of separation falls away. It's almost as if you are me and I am you. And so our response comes from the heart. It doesn't come from obligation. I hope that's really good news. I hope that makes you happy. And it also means that there's no obligation, there's no hurry. You know, when you're ready, when your heart's ready, you'll respond in your way. And I could well imagine that there are people, because in other situations I've been this way, where there's been a major tragedy in my neighborhood, my neighbors, or with the world out there. And I've said, you know, this has affected me. I feel the suffering. But, you know, I'm not going to do anything to this one directly. But I will be influenced by it. I will be affected by it. And as I'm affected by it, I'm going to try to figure out how to do better elsewhere. How to respond better in some other way to this life of ours. Try to make a difference in this world of ours. And in some situations, I move to respond in some more direct way. So I don't know if that made sense, but sometimes it's direct and sometimes it's quite indirect. If we experience the suffering of the world around us and we're distressed by it, or we feel guilty because of it, then you are like the second monk who didn't put the woman down. What are you holding on to? What are you carrying if you feel distress? But what happens if you don't drop the distress and trust your heart? Because a lot of distress and guilt has to come with judgments, ideas of what should and shouldn't be, concepts we add on top of the situations. But what happens if we just trust our heart and see what arises? Or trust some deeper part of ourselves. What comes through us as a result of that? Okay, I guess that's enough. It's time anyway. So thank you. And I hope that whatever mindfulness practice you do, that the windows to your, or say the windows to your mind, the windows to your observation, to your seeing, is open in all directions, inwardly and outwardly. Thank you.